the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Johnny Nicol with you. And Johnny, it's absolutely terrific to have you join me with Sam away on his jollies. But I think it's safe to say we're both feeling a bit worse for wear after our teams were on the end of some very disappointing results over the weekend.
Hi, Ben. It's good to be here. Sam's off enjoying himself, but maybe we're not enjoying ourselves quite so much. But hopefully this will be a cathartic experience for both of us. And then hopefully there's lots of action. There's lots of goals, lots of incidents, lots of stuff to kind of distract ourselves with.
Yeah, I reckon it. There wasn't the best weekend for both Johnny's Gumba Osaka and my side FC Tokyo. But yeah, we'll come on to those results later. But yeah, as Johnny said, so much to sink our teeth into from the weekend's match day 21. But we can't let last Wednesday's round of games, so match day 20, pass without a mention at the top of the episode. And with Kawasaki versus Tosu postponed and Kashima needing a frankly unbelievable 89th minute bicycle kick Puskas nominee from a substitute Everaldo to earn them a 3-3 draw at home against Cerezo Osaka, Yokohama F. Marinos extended their lead at the top of the table to 5 points after they wore down Hiroshima in a terrific match at the Nissan Stadium. Johnny, Sanfrecce certainly gave as good as they got in a matchup of the hottest teams in the league, but Yohei Takaoka in the home net proved too tough a nut to crack. And after F. Marinos took the lead just past the half hour through an unlikely source in left back Yuta Koike, Takuma Nishimura continued his purple patch with yet another goal just before the hour. And Ryo Miichi continued his happy knack of putting icing on the cake with the clincher in second half stoppage time.
Yeah, this was a game a lot of people were excited about. And in a sense, it's a shame that it was kind of buried on a Wednesday night. So at least we have a chance to talk about it now. I think as Sam said in his Patreon roundup, and a big shout out to Sam while he's not here. That was great what he did in the time he put it out. It was fantastic to read. But I think Sam said that the scoreline does flatter Marinos a bit. But as we know with Marinos, that style of play, the amount they run, if you make one mistake, they'll catch you out. And they do tend to put icing on the cake late on in games. And that's one of the sources of their success. Another one is, like you mentioned, the first goal scorer was Yuta Koike, who just kind of came in from nowhere to play left back. He pops up with a goal. So it's a huge win for Marinos. And I think we'll obviously talk about both Marinos and Hiroshima later. It is a kind of maybe a bit of a sign. Hiroshima, a few too many games in too short a space of time. The squad depth was severely tested. And they beat Marinos 2-0 at home. They've come out second best here. But yeah, I think most of us are pretty convinced these are two of the top top five teams in the league this year.
Yeah, most definitely. And, well, you asked Sam and myself last week about Leo Ciara and Takuma Nishimura. So, well, how about you could chime in yourself on them. And Nishimura here getting the second goal, the all-important second to give Marinos some breathing space in this game. As we both said, yeah, Hiroshima were well up for the fight in this game. And F. Marinos did ultimately need that second goal cushion that Nishimura provided. And, well, he's just simply been a revelation, hasn't he, this season? Coming into the team fairly unheralded, of course, coming over from Sendai. But, he's settled in remarkably well.
Yeah, because it's interesting. The last time I was on last month, we're doing our team of the half season, and naturally compared it to last year when Kawasaki were the dominant force, they were the highest scorers, and Damian was the top scorer, and it was an easy decision to award Damian like our MVP award, and he got the official award as well. Whereas this year, as we know, like the league table is so diverse, there's good players at many different teams, and you know. Now there's still plenty of games to play, but you're kind of thinking, like, who would shape up as an MVP? And on his latest run of form, like, Nishimura is certainly throwing his hat into the ring, because when we did the team of the half year, it was based on 16 games, and Muscat's rotated Marinos a lot more than other teams. So it's difficult in some cases to make a case for someone who's only played 10 games versus someone who's played 15 or 16. But with a 34-game season, someone with 28, 29 games is quite easy to put in. So Nishimura, as I might come on to when we talk about the Cerezo game, like his teammates, Wednesday night took something out of him, so he wasn't quite as good, but he's been in scintillating form. And talking about scintillating form, Leo Sierra, I think he's always someone who'll occupy defenders. They'll know they're in a game when he's there, but suddenly he's just added goals and prolific goals to his game, and just, yeah, he looks unstoppable at the moment. And yeah, this isn't the last conversation we're going to have about him tonight.
No, you are spot on, Johnny. All right, so before we move off Wednesday, let's switch to the Kashima versus Cerezo game. And if you wouldn't mind, a word on the Everaldo goal. Mine is preposterous.
Maybe I've got a little story to tell about Everaldo, because of course, like the last year and a half, goals like that have definitely not been part of his repertoire. He's been very down in confidence, and I think his goal before that, Yuma Suzuki gave him the ball for the penalty specifically to build up his confidence, and it clearly paid off. But I remember a game back in 2020, Gamba beat Kashima at home, and Everaldo tried that exact same shot from about 45 yards out with two defenders on him, and I think it went about 45 yards wide. And I think that shot basically started my interest in expected goals, because I thought, well, you can't count that as a shot and goal. It was never going to go in, but I guess it's proof if you try and try and try again, then good things will come your way. So well done to Everaldo. That was a wonderful goal.
Yeah, I hope by now, listeners, you've been able to track down a clip. If you weren't watching the game live, it's, well, yeah, to be quite frank, it should win the best goal in the world this year. So, and yeah, as Sam said in his, as we mentioned for the second time in this episode, his Patreon-only write-up on last Wednesday's game. Yeah, I mean, from a personal perspective, I'm feeling really, really sorry for Kazuya Kondo, because he scored an absolutely tremendous goal to take the clubhouse lead the previous Saturday, of course, in the J-Talk goal of the season. And yes, literally 3 days later, Everaldo was done that. And yeah, Kondo's goal is now but just a distant memory. But simply stunning. Numerous words we could use to describe it. But yeah, just absolutely phenomenal. No question from the big man. All right, then. So let's switch our attention to the weekend's match day 21. Both Kawasaki and Tosu were back in action, as we'll come on to shortly. But we'll begin again with the leaders, who were traveled down to Osaka to face Cerezo. And, well, it doesn't get any tougher, Johnny, does it, than facing the top two in back-to-back games. But that was the equation presented to Cerezo, and they've emerged from their two games with massive credit, yet still a sense of what might have been. We've just mentioned Everaldo's worldie turning 3 points into one at the death on Wednesday, and then they were 2-0 up late on against the table toppers on Sunday, only for F. Marino's old boy Ryosuke Yamanaka's 79th minute straight red card to open the door. And Leo Sierra, the previously mentioned striker, banged it down late with a late brace. The first from the penalty spot as a result of Yamanaka's foul, and then the equaliser coming in the second minute of second half stoppage time.
Yeah, this was a good game. I think this was the game of the round. It shaped up as a game of the round before it started, and I think it delivered. Granted, all of these teams have played three games this match week, and it really did show at times. I looked at the post-match stats, and Marinos as a team ran 18 kilometres less against Cerezo than they did against Hiroshima. Mm. As someone who lives in Osaka, it was very hot and it was extremely humid on Sunday night. I went out for a walk about an hour after the game finished, and it was really, really humid. So I think with that in mind, I think the game was played at a decent tempo. I think Cerezo's opener was very much against the run of play. Marinos started the game well, and my criticism actually of Cerezo in the opening half hour was that they didn't press enough, especially when Marinos had the ball at the back, and Marinos were able to move the ball comfortably out of their own defensive third, and they definitely looked the most likely to score. But then all of a sudden, Cerezo pressed the ball. There's a bit of a slack pass into Fujita, and then what a finish by Kato. And then also the second goal, Adam Taggart, who then had to go off injured. I think he was only on for about 15 minutes. But you know, my man, Seiya Maekuma, who was a wonderful player at Viva in Nagasaki, he really looked like he should have been a J1 player long before he was. A lovely touch to set up that goal. But Yeah, I'm not a Sarrozo fan, but I am playing the Sam neutral role for most of tonight's pod. So you have to feel for them, don't you? Because they are a very, very under the radar team. Because I was looking at the stats, like since they came back up in 2017, last year's the only year they haven't been in the top seven. But they're not really a team you ever really talk about as being one of these, like one of the really big clubs. But in many ways, they perform as well as, or if not better than a lot of bit bigger clubs like cough Gamba. So yeah, as a neutral, it's easy to feel a bit sorry for them. And yeah, that second goal by Leo Ciara, what a cross by Iwata for a start, and then pinpoint header from Ciara under pressure to beat a keeper like Kim Jin-hyun from that range. Yeah, that was championship metal, we might say, from Marinos. They were not at their best away to a very difficult opponent. I would argue, we were discussing in the green room, we're not quite sure about the rule, but I think that in the Dogso, Yamanaka, if it results in a penalty, I feel that's extremely harsh to get a red card and a penalty, because you're essentially giving Marinos a better chance to score than they already had. It's not like something that's outside the box. I would argue if Kim Jin-hyun saves that ball, he pushes it to safety, the game probably finishes 2-0. Still, if it's 2-1 and Yamanaka stays on, there's still every chance Marinos would equalise, because they did have their tails up. Mm. But yeah, I wonder what you thought about that, Ben, the sending off of Yamanaka, that rule. I think that the VAR has been correct in how it's interpreted the law, but do you agree with that, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, again, I'm no rules expert, but I thought the double jeopardy or the triple jeopardy or whatever it was called, and you know, it was set up so that teams wouldn't be it's triple punished, right? They lose a man, they lose a goal, and then they whatever it is. It's only taking me 30 seconds to get myself tied up in knots, but yeah, I think it's the punishment of the penalty and losing the man is very harsh in this circumstance. Again, a qualified referee, a rules expert, can tell me that the referee and the VAR have ultimately come to the correct decision. But yes, it's definitely a foul. There's no question about that. So for my mind, that's a penalty. But I don't see the need to send Yamanaka off at the same time. But again, I stand to be corrected, and I'm sure someone will joyfully tell me that I've got that very wrong. But yeah, overall, it's a tough one to take. But the result as a whole, and the week's exertions, Cerezo players must have just been absolutely spent at the full-time whistle. As you mentioned, the heat, having to play such a pressure cooker game, 4 days after they'd done the same up in Kashima on the Wednesday. And yeah, for to be in winning positions so late on in both games, and be literally moments away from banking 6 points and only having to settle for two, must be very frustrating for Mr. Kogiku and his players. But at the same time, yeah, I think we can really see the development of a real interesting looking squad here, can't we? And it's a really interesting mix of young and old. And I'm really fascinated to see how far they can go in the second half of the season, Johnny, because I think they're one of the teams to watch, no question, for the remainder of the season.
Well, you mentioned that the Kashima and Marinos throwing away those 4 points late on. If they had those 4 points, but they would be in fourth place. And given that they don't have to play Kashima again, and they don't have to play Marinos again, the running is not massively difficult. I have them they've fallen behind Kashiwa, and we'll get on to Kashiwa later. I think in the greatest respect to Kashiwa, I think they might slip away a bit, and I'd see Cerezo as a solid top five team. They do have a deeper squad than Hiroshima, but I think I mentioned before the first Osaka derby of the season that Cerezo hadn't put back-to-back wins together. That win over Gamba started a run of three wins in a row, but then since that run, again, they haven't won back-to-back games. So that's definitely something Kogiku will be looking to build on. They do have quite a big squad, and they've had quite a few injuries this season. I don't know if they're going to be looking to be in the market. I know they have issues at left back because Marahashi's out for the year, and then Yamanaka just come back and he'll be suspended. And then, poor Adam Taggart, he's he comes on as a sub and then he scores a goal and then he's down with another leg injury. They just can't catch a break. But, you know, I think, yes, Serra's a team I think you'd be looking about to be somewhere in the range of third to fifth. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I said, I think last week or 2 weeks ago that Serra were, you know, the sort of team that once you start to big them up, they'll, you know, they might go on a winless run and show their inconsistencies. But then, of course, when you consider the fact that they've just come up against the top two, and as I said, we're so close to winning both of those games, I think overall we can give them a pass on these two results and give them, you know, deserved plaudits for their performances over the two games as a whole. I mean, you know, you said yourself that, I mean, they barely touched the ball in the first half hour of this game. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, once they took the lead through Mutsuki Kato's terrific goal, then, yeah, it looked like they were giving as good as they got against F. Marinos, who are the cream of the crop in this league at the moment. I don't think there's any question about that. So, yeah, as I say, I'm fascinated to see how they could go. And if there's any sort of a drop-off from the teams above them, and, yeah, whether Reysol will ultimately fall away. I mean, we've been expecting that for the last couple of months now, but they've managed to dig in the top six. We'll wait and see. But yeah, I mean, again, the fact that they got these two performances out of their team without their talisman and captain Hiroshi Kiyotake involved while he's still out injured, then I think that says a lot about the yeah, the depth that they've got coming through. And yeah, we'll wait and see, as I say, how they get on in the second half of the season. I guess, you know, we've waxed lyrical about F. Marinos on a weekly basis for the past couple of months, Johnny. So I think, you know, what you said was right. This was a mark of a really strong team to come from behind when they weren't at their best. And yeah, well, they couldn't literally win every game from now to the end of the season. Their winning streak has come to a halt. But yeah, Kevin Muscat will have, you know, I'm sure, been expecting a result like this to come along sooner rather than later, especially with yeah, the conditions and the yeah, the games coming in such quick succession. So yeah, the fact they were still able to bank a point and yeah, not lose any of their advantage over second place Kashima, as we'll come on to in the next game, I think overall is a positive result for them. And well, yeah, they Wednesday night, I mean, you know, it had all the hallmarks of a game of the season. And yeah, it's maybe didn't quite deliver to the level we'd hoped. But yeah, F. Marinos have certainly got through a lot of work in the past, yeah, week and a bit. As you say, three games for pretty much all of the teams in the league is a big ask at this time of year, considering the conditions. So, yeah, well done to both of these teams for putting on such an entertaining game. And yes, for sharing the spoils on Sunday night. Well, the game that began Sunday's slate, Johnny, was up at the Sapporo Dome. It also ended in a draw, but this was of the goalless variety. Sapporo hosted second-placed Kashima Antlers, who were without their talisman, Yuma Suzuki. That meant a start for Everaldo up front, but he was unable to repeat his heroics from Wednesday night. And yeah, I think we can move off this fairly swiftly, Johnny. There weren't a massive amount of chances for either team. It's looked like neither team could have too many complaints about this result at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think I watched the whole game, but my advice to anyone who's listening and hasn't seen any of the highlights, just have a look at the statistics. That tells you everything you need to know about this game. There's no Ueda, no Suzuki, and no real cutting edge up front for Kashima, who again, but both of these teams look like the teams we mentioned above. They had three games this week, three tough games. Kashima, slightly worrying signs. I think the fans weren't slow to let them know about it. I think there was a kind of slightly ugly incident with Anzai and some shirtless and maskless fans at the Sapporo Dome. But yeah, I think as Sam said, I think in his, if I can mention his Patreon guide again, we're not getting paid to mention it, but I think he quoted something like Sapporo looked like a good team until they go a goal behind, and they were never a goal behind in this game. I would add in the sort of caveat, I think in the rare event where a Sapporo game goes to 15 minutes to go and it's still 0-0, that then they tend to just go for it a bit too much. And that was the only time Kashima really threatened was at the end. They pushed Kaike up front, made a few changes, taking off some of their wounded warriors. But I wasn't too impressed with many players. Pituka did some decent stuff in midfield, and I think Okamura at the back for Sapporo impressed me a bit. But yeah, I think it was quite, yeah, it was a bit of a turgid game. Two teams who really need a new striker, because I think Kuroki's back for Sapporo and Ogashiba's coming back soon, but Gabriel Xavier's out, that they still haven't really replaced Chanatip. So I think they're still struggling to score enough goals. And yeah, Kashima, that Everaldo and your favourite Shoma Doi, it looks very good on paper, but there's probably not an awful lot of minutes playing together recently. So it really did look like a step down without Ueda or Suzuki there. And you know, if you told me that the three games I watched live this weekend, two of them will have four goals and one of them will have none, I would not have picked this before kickoff as the one without any goals. But yeah, I'm sorry, Sapporo, you know, Kashima fans, that there wasn't too much for either side to get excited about. How about you, Ben? Like, in terms of Kashima, do you expect them, would you think they would go into the market to replace Ueda, or do you think they might try and look to replace him internally, or any ideas about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, if they're liking what they're seeing from Everaldo in training, then they might try and wing it. But yeah, I mean, considering the way he dropped off last season, yeah, it's hard for me personally to put that massive amount of faith in him. But yeah, for a club with the ambitions of Kashima, I certainly wouldn't be surprised if they went into the market. I haven't heard any rumours of anything at this stage, but I guess they've already brought back their big fish in the off-season, haven't they? And Yuma has certainly not let anybody down. So, yeah, they might see what they can do. But I certainly share your concern. And, you know, a game like this away at Sapporo, considering how, you know, attacking they usually are and how open their games are, yeah, the fact that they haven't been able to break through while missing, yeah, obviously key personnel, but yeah, that is an indication of perhaps their lack of depth up front. And yeah, it pains me to say, but yeah, poor old Shoma, he's had a couple of chances in the starting lineup now, and is yet to repay Rene Vila's faith. But hopefully that will come sooner rather than later, and yeah, he might get an extended run in the team, and hopefully he'll justify that faith if it does eventuate. I guess for Sapporo is the fact that Takanori Sugano was back between the sticks. That meant that they were far more likely to keep the opposition at bay. Of course, Sugano was suspended for Wednesday night's trip to FC Tokyo, and Sapporo shipped three goals and lost 3-0. But Sugano back, and that was enough for another clean sheet for Sapporo. And Antlers left to rue the chance, although of course they didn't know it at the time that F Marinos were later going to drop points as well. But yes, they've the status quo has continued in the top two, with both of those sides drawing. And all right, Johnny, well, like a band-aid, we better do it in one motion and rip it right off and head to events at Todoroki on Saturday. One of the two games that kicked off the match day on Saturday was Kawasaki hosting Gamba Osaka. And there were interesting news at the selection table for Kawasaki. There was a first start in four games since the international break for both Leandro Damião and Marcinho, while Kento Tachibanada was back in central midfield and Asahi Sasaki returned at left back. We might be able to put two and two together and suggest all that corresponded with manager Toru Oniki being absent from the touchline due to COVID, with head coach Shuhei Terada taking charge for the game. But regardless, Damião celebrated his return to the 11 with a first league goal in 3 months, firing home first time in just the sixth minute after Marcinho sent over a delicious first time cross with the outside of his right boot. Johnny, the Gamba boss, Tomohiro Katanosaka, rested Dawan and paired Kohei Okuno with Mitsuki Saito in central midfield. But a minute after Gamba fell behind, Okuno slid in on Sasaki, and his right boot caught Sasaki in a sensitive area, to put it nicely, with the referee changing his initial decision of a yellow card to a straight red after being summoned to the monitor. So a really unfortunate turn of events. I mean, early doors, I mean, it's so soon after falling behind. I mean, it's a bit extreme to say it completely killed the game. But, well, yeah, for Gumba, I mean, there could hardly have been worse timing.
Yeah, well, I think I said to you in the green room when if I dropped my veil of neutrality, I'd had a rough day at work, and then I tuned in to see the game afterwards. And then obviously Kawasaki scored a very, very good goal. You mentioned like Marcinho was back in the starting lineup. I think he played very well whole game, and he combined well with Chanatip. And Damian, I think you mentioned his last goal was 3 months ago. I'm pretty sure that might have been against Gamba, that one in the 95th minute. He always plays well against us. And I think I was actually asked, because in my match preview, I'd chosen him ahead of Kobayashi. And my reasoning was he always plays well against Gamba, and he always plays against Gamba. So I don't know if Oniki had anything to do with that or not, but it was a good choice by whoever made it. But then, yeah, the Okuno incident, I think for me, it ruined the game. I'm sure there's Kawasaki fans in the stadium, and Neil Debnam among them, who probably rejoiced. But yeah, I was very annoyed by this on Saturday. It's now Monday night. I've calmed down a little bit. But the angle I'm going to take is the decision a human would make about this versus the decision a computerized system would take. What actually happens in real time is that the referee gives Okuno a yellow card. As always happens in this situation, a couple of the experienced players quickly say to the referee, I think it was Ian Aga and Damian, you're going to check that in VAR? The ref says yes. But essentially, everyone just gets on with preparing for a Kawasaki free kick. Mm. And they're about to take it. And then the ref's called over. And then they zoom in and they slow motion it 10 times. And then the red card comes out. And when you look at that, I'm not going to say it's not a red card. When you look at it on the VAR, it's, as you say, it's a sensitive area. Okuno's foot goes up. But what I would say is, again, when you look at the incident, Okuno slides in. He wins the ball well before he gets to Sasaki. It's early in the game. He's clearly surprised by how slidey the pitch is. And he slides into Sasaki. And the boot goes up, which looks terrible on screen. But if anyone's ever played futsal and they're about to collide with a board, the natural reaction is to sort of strengthen your leg and brace for impact, which I think is what Okuno did, because he's not a dirty player. If anything, he's the opposite. He's too soft, and he really needs to work on toughening up a bit. So, yeah, I'd say a red card is a red card, in that the player is removed from the field and they get an automatic suspension from the next game. But as we all know, a red card in the 77th minute and a red card in the 87th minute, like a red card in the 7th minute is a massive punishment on a team having to play nearly the entire game with 10 men. Is what happened, is that bad enough to warrant a red card? Because I put an alternative situation. The game takes place in 2019. Kawasaki score an early goal, 1-0 up. That happens. It's a yellow card. Everyone gets on with it. Kawasaki win the game 2-0, 2-1. That challenge is not talked about here. It's not talked about on judge replay. It's not talked about anywhere. Mm. VAR has come in. It's making... We've got 3 red cards to talk about this week. More players are getting sent off. Do they need to be? So I'm aware maybe there's some sour grapes coming out. So Ben, you're more neutral in this, although it is Kawasaki, so I don't know if you might take my side. But what did you make of this incident?
Well, yeah, I'm sour grapes about Tokyo on a weekly basis, Johnny, so you don't have to worry about that. You're in good company. Don't worry about that. Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. My only counter would be that I sometimes criticise J-League referees for refereeing to context. And yes, a 7th minute foul is often not punished as severely as I think it should be at times. So whether this was an example of a player definitely needing to get sent off is I think I can certainly see your argument. I mean, when you watch the replay a number of times, it obviously looks very painful for Sasaki, and it's we're thankful he was able to carry on with the game, and hopefully it means he'll still be able to have children in his future. But I mean, I see where you're coming from, where there's a kind of a self-preservation aspect to it for Okuno, where the right boot goes up kind of unnaturally. Like, you're asking yourself, well, why has he just kicked him in the balls, to be frank? Yeah. But yeah, it's because he's bracing himself for that impact. And I'm walking on both sides of the fence here, because I mean, it is reckless. And yes, if he's taken by surprise by the slippiness of the pitch, then, I mean, that means he's reckless and he's out of control at the same time. So, again, it is a tricky one because, you hate to see a game killed off in the first 10 minutes. But at the same time, I've kind of got to walk the walk and say that I have at times criticized referees for not making a big decision like this. I can take your point as well on the fact that, yes, this wouldn't have been a sending off before the VAR era. So at the end of the day, it's a tough one to take for, as you say, not a dirty player. And this isn't necessarily a dirty act, but yeah, the way it looks, I guess I can see how the officiating team have come to this decision. But at the same time, it is definitely a difficult one to take.
Yeah, I think, as soon as the ref went over to VAR, I think everyone knew what was going to happen. Once you look at it, he's off. And I think all I asked for, I'm not saying I'm not in the right here. I was angry from a Gamba supporter's perspective. And there's a lot of factors that have gone into that this season. But I think you've kind of taken a point. And Neil Debnam, actually, I messaged him. We talked about this kind of on Sunday and Monday. And he did say, I see your point. And I'd like to think anyone listening that, don't try and imagine it's not a Gamba player. Imagine it's a player for your team. You've just got to go down tough away game to Kawasaki, Mariners, Antlers, whoever. And then that happens. It'd be interesting to know what fans of other teams think. If you think about it from the perspective of my team's player was sent off, not just Kohei Okano from Gamba.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, it was a difficult situation for Gamba to have to play basically the last 80 minutes of the game with only 10 men, already a goal down. So we mentioned that Marcinho set up Damião for the opener. Well, in the 20th minute, Damião returned the favour and slipped in Marcinho, who blasted high into the net past Masaki Higashiguchi. Then on the half hour, Marcinho stepped over a ball in from the left from Sasaki, and Yasuto Wakizaka finished first time to Higashiguchi's left, much to my chagrin, as I played my fantasy wildcard this week and took both Damião and Wakizaka out. So I was feeling the pain. Not quite as much as yourself, Johnny, with the way these goals are raining in for Kawasaki. But the coup de grace was applied 9 minutes before the break when Akihiro Iyanaga's bicycle kick sent Frontale into a 4-0 lead. That held till half time, and well, you drew the second half, Johnny. So Higashiguchi made a couple of decent saves, or more than a couple, and Yu Kobayashi rattled the crossbar with a drive from distance late on. It was it was against 10 men, but was this the game that turned it around for the champions? We'll wait and see. Of course, in the weeks ahead, they sit to 7 points behind F. Marinos with a game in hand and a meeting with the leaders at Todoroki on the horizon in 3 rounds time. But Gamba, Johnny, you're now just 2 points ahead of bottom club Iwata, but with the cavalry arriving. Talk us through Gamba's incomings and how they can help dig the club out of danger.
Well, at the moment, we've got two new signings confirmed. The big one is Musashi Suzuki, who's come back from a spell in Belgium. And I think in his early G League career, he maybe played in the wing a bit more, and he wasn't so much of a goal scorer. But certainly in his latter days with Sapporo, he scored a lot of goals. Crucially, he comes in with the Katano Saka stamp of approval, because I think it's something that I think affects both of our clubs. And I've talked to fans of other teams too, and other Gamba fans. There's a lot of teams in the league that the people signing the players and the people actually in charge of selecting the teams have differing ideas on who should be in a squad. And that's definitely, if you're looking at a league table and you look at 15th, 16th, 17th in particular, Gamba, Kobe, Espels, I think there's a lot of those issues at those three clubs. But Suzuki seems to be one who ticks the box. Front office want him, fans are happy, and Kato Nasaka sees him as a starter. Obviously, I don't think you mentioned that Harumi Minamino unfortunately made his starting debut in this game, and he only had 7 minutes to make an impact. I said to Neil in a pre-match text, it's either going to go one of two ways, and he didn't do anything personally, but the game obviously went the wrong way for Gamba. But I mean, Minamino was chosen ahead of Sakamoto and Patrick. Sakamoto was rotated out, Patrick wasn't, so essentially that's the kind of striker that, that Katana Saka wants. He doesn't want Patrick unless it's just hoofing balls up, as it ended up being in the second half here. So I think Suzuki's been training with his teammates, or he will have been training for about 2 weeks by the time the Osaka Derby rolls around. So he could very well start this Saturday. The other player, Ryotaro Meshino, I think fans might remember from 2019. He scored three very nice goals in his, I think, 12 games. He's only played about 23 games for Gamba, played more for the under-23s. Mm. He's had a kind of disappointing spell in Europe. With Meshino, he's a good player and the fans are happy to have him back. But I think if he wasn't Gamba youth, I don't think Katana Saka would really go out of his way to sign him. So I'm interested to see how he uses him. Again, I'm not sure if he'll be back for this game. He might actually come in against Kyoto on the 30th, but those two have already arrived. In my head, I'm working with a number of about five or six new arrivals. I think Gamba will bring in a new central midfielder. There's talk of Chuse Jong going back to Korea. I think they'll bring in a new central midfielder, another attacker, potentially a wing back, and probably a centre back. I have rumours or the murmurings around the club. I think there's been quite a lot of ins, and there's potentially Leandro Pereira, who just hasn't worked out at all for Gamba, but I still think is actually a good player at the right club in J1. I know Iwata were rumoured in for him. Wellington Silva falls into that category. Juse Jong, there might be a couple of others go out, but I think it's going to be quite a busy summer at Gamba. Again, it sounds positive to say that players are coming in. But again, like those teams I mentioned, like Shimizu, Gamba, Kobe, part of the reason they're in the problem, they're in the trouble they are right now is that poor front office work. So giving them more chances to do front office work isn't necessarily going to fix the problem. But I'm hoping and believing that in this case it is actually Gamba's key out of the relegation dogfight.
Right, right. So we got a couple of questions in from our patrons for this episode. And yeah, Gabriel Anello answered the call, as he often does. So thanks for your questions, Gab. One was Gamba specific, Johnny. So Gab says Gamba are in trouble, but he still believes that sacking Katana Saka would be counterproductive. Johnny, I presume, Gab asks how you feel about this. I presume, don't want to put words into your mouth, but yeah, I mean, you certainly want to be giving him more than half a season.
Yeah, I agree with both of Gab's points. Gamba are in trouble. I think I think most people, most observers of J-League are on board with that. And yeah, the biggest problem, which I've kind of touched on, is obviously is actually the start of last season, where 2020 it was a slog for everyone. Gamba just played defensively, and then Miyamoto had other ideas at the start of 2021. He wanted to play 4-3-3, brought in Pereira, Silva, Juse Jong. He really fought for Juse Jong to come in. They played one league game and then had the Corona cluster, and then they're playing again all the time. So they just went back to those 2020 tactics, and Miyamoto was gone soon after that. We're just sort of We've meandered along, and then we've brought in Katana Saka, who has a completely different philosophy in how to play football. So we've got all these high earners like Pereira, Juse Jong, Silva, Gen Shoji even. I think they don't really fit into a Katana Saka system. I think if he was playing fantasy football and he could build his squad from scratch, I don't think he'd be bringing in any of those players. And Gen Tamura probably falls into that category too, but I don't see him leaving any time soon. So the biggest problem has been bringing in players A, B and C for manager D and then changing manager D very quickly after that. So Katana Saka, yeah, I'm not going to say he's done a brilliant job. He's got him in 15th position or 13th last year, but he does know the style of football he wants to play. And I'm sure in the time he's been there, he's identified who he does and doesn't want. So I think, as Gab said, it'd be completely counterproductive to bring a brand new manager in with players that you've then signed for the previous manager. That's just asking to go down to J2. There's been murmurings, and there are people have said bad things in the Gamba support about how the team are playing and how Katana Saka is doing. But he does have the goodwill of being there as assistant to Hasegawa and Nishino. It's not like a Lavir Kulpi style appointment where the fans will be on his back from the minute he came in. He's almost got that much clout he could survive a relegation with caveats. If Gamba were to struggle in J2 the following year, I think he'd be gone. But he does have good standing with the Gamba support. And I think Sam mentioned a few weeks ago, there's always something going wrong at Gamba. You know, like as I naturally leapt to in the Kawasaki game, I didn't focus on the 4-0. I focused on one, the horrible schedule Gamba had versus Kawasaki in the build up, and then VAR. So he's not really a lightning rod for protests yet. Other things are still getting it, and the Usami injury, things like that keep going wrong. So yeah, fully agree with what Gab said, and yeah, I'm not someone, if anyone ever hears me on JTET, I'm never someone to call for managers to go, especially when, you know, it's a very difficult job for anyone to come into. So I'm supporting Katano Saka now. I mean, I guess you're again from a neutral perspective, would you kind of, if that was the kind of thing happening at FC Tokyo, would you be of the same mind, or would you want to change things about now?
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of the, you know, the stature of the manager at the club, it's completely different to what FC Tokyo have done with the bringing in Albert Pucci this season. And I mean, there are a number of positions between us in the table, but you know, I think it's eight positions and it's 8 points, and you know, Tokyo have struggled mightily at times as well. And you know, I think Pucci started, as we're going to come on to shortly, I mean, he started trying to clear out some of the dead wood literally today, Monday. And yeah, he knows that he's got a long-term project that he wants to implement, and you know, changing the culture of the club and changing the personnel and getting the right players in that can play the way that he wants to. And you know, whether he will ultimately end up being the right man for the job, we'll wait and see down the line. But yeah, from my perspective, I want to see him given more time and given you know, ample opportunity to to get the players he wants and to implement the methods that he wants Tokyo to play. So I can see why there would be frustration amongst the Gamba support. But yeah, again, when it's somebody with, you know, so much goodwill built up amongst large swathes of the supporter base, there will always be some who are, you know, dissatisfied with let's not sugarcoat it. It has been a very disappointing season to this point for Gamba, and a lot of supporters will have been, you know, hoping for a lot better. But hopefully the players that he's starting to get in now will gel quickly, and he'll be able to really identify a good squad of, you know, 17, 18, 19 players that he knows he can count on for the remainder of the season, and, you know, gradually work out or eke out the ones that he doesn't want, and they can move on to pastures new, and hopefully he'll be able to take Gamba forward. And I'm sure that will be in J1. We're not going to utter the old too good to go down mantra, because, you know, that doesn't apply in the J League, does it, Johnny? Because we've seen so many, in inverted commas, big clubs go down over the years, and you know, both of our clubs have suffered that fate in the past 10 or 12 years. Gamba can turn it around, and they can look at the example of the team now directly below them in the table, who have just reeled off three straight victories, to know that it only takes a little spell of good form, you know, the breaks going your way, and suddenly you're on a little bit of a roll. That got you to second place in 2020, didn't it? So I'm sure there's light at the end of the tunnel, and we want to see Mr. Katano Saka allowed to carry on and continue his methods. So before we move off Gamba, is there anything else you wanted to say? Is there anything else you wanted to get off your chest, or are we okay to move on?
Well, I'll just add a very quick point about what you said there about it just takes a little run.
Yeah.
Now is very much the time, because they're playing Cerezo, and then after the break for the EAFF Cup, they have Kyoto home, Fukuoka away, Shimizu home. Yeah, 7 points minimum from those three games, and then I think Gamba can start to look up. 1 point, 2 points, 3 points, 4 points, then the song says there may be trouble ahead.
yes, well, obviously a huge one on Saturday at the Suita City Stadium, so that's the first thing I'm sure that's occupying Mr. Katanosaka's mind at the moment. And hopefully Gamba can turn it on for their home support and put in a stirring display, because I mean, it was only a couple of weeks ago, Johnny, that we were thinking that, you know, things were starting to turn around, and then it obviously hasn't been a great week with the loss to Shonan on Wednesday, and then the early Okano red card putting Gamba right behind the eight ball on Saturday night. All right, well, yeah, we'll head next to the Edion Stadium in Hiroshima, where there was a milestone evening for Sanfrecce club legend Toshihiro Aoyama, who set a new club record with his 431st appearance for Sanfrecce on Sunday. The hosts look to bounce back from Wednesday's defeat at the Nissan Stadium that we mentioned off the top of the episode, but they were caught out by a revitalized Shonan side that gave them a taste of their own medicine, Johnny. Belmare pressed very effectively. They dominated the first half chances and took a deserved lead with a well-worked goal and a fine finish from Masaki Ikeda 7 minutes into the second half.
Yeah, I only caught the highlights of this game, but definitely from that and looking at the stats, it seemed like the first half and early into the second, Shonan were the better team. Again, I've mentioned it before, I'll mention it again, both of these teams had this was the third hard game of the week, and Shonan, of course, had just played Gamba, and that was a big game down the bottom, whereas Hiroshima had had the game with Marino. So I think a lot those teams would have invested a lot into their midweek game, and this game kind of came as an afterthought. But yeah, Shonan have been in great form recently, haven't they? They're, I think, 17 points from the last 8 games. They're fourth in the standings if you look at the form over the last 10 weeks. Yeah, Yamaguchi, he was struggling at the start of this year, but he's got them very hard to beat. They're winning games ugly. There was no, I think Machino was on the bench after he got a nasty looking ankle injury the previous week, but he'd only missed the game against Gamba. But yeah, he really caught Sanfrecce in their heels. I think it was Takahashi with a low ball. I can't imagine Skiba being too happy with a ball played at that pace and only being slightly dummied, just kind of rolling slowly into the path of Ikeda. But he's been in quite good form. I think he set up the winner against Gamba in midweek, and he's picked up a couple of goals and assists recently. And yeah, he came up from Fukushima in J3s. So he's taken a little time to find his feet, but he's definitely been someone I think has developed under Yamaguchi, who, yeah, despite seeing off Gamba midweek, I've got a bit of a soft spot for after obviously being a club legend, and I wasn't really sure how that appointment would go. It kind of seemed a bit like the cheap option to me at the time, but yeah, he's definitely doing a good job, and early in this game he got the upper hand in his opposite number.
Yeah, most definitely. They looked really bright, didn't they? And it's been a pretty remarkable turnaround, really. And I guess the win over Kobe at home in match day 14 was a huge one. And then to go away from home and beat Kawasaki 4-0 was, we called it the biggest shock in J-League history. So from there, they've pretty much not put a foot wrong, although they did lose the next game to Cerezo. But since then, they've gone 5 unbeaten. And that included, of course, the win over Gamba at home on Wednesday. So they took a deserved lead, as we mentioned, early in the second half, but once they had let in the equaliser in frustrating circumstances in the 67th minute, it's fair to say they were hanging on and were very grateful for the full-time whistle and the point that they were able to pocket at that time. So, yeah, the equaliser came when Yuki Nogami headed in off the post from a yard out after the Belmare defence failed to clear a corner. And, well, then it almost went from bad to worse for Shonan when a Gakuto Notsuda free kick caused havoc. The Hiroshima defender Yuta Imazu looked certain to score from a yard out, but Koki Tachi managed to hack the ball off the line. Then from the resulting corner, the ball was flicked on and an unmarked Nogami somehow managed to head against the bar from 3 yards. But a five-match unbeaten run, as we both said, has been very impressive from Shonan and taken them up to the giddy heights of a 13th in the table. Not so long ago, of course, they were rock bottom. But deserve enormous credit for their turnaround. A frustrating week ultimately for Hiroshima, Johnny. They would have had such high expectations of themselves when they headed up to Yokohama on Wednesday night. Of course, that game didn't go as they would have wished. And then, they returned home. They wouldn't have been complacent at all, I'm sure, with Shonan heading in. But yeah, obviously looked the easier of the two games. But I guess the exertions of the past week, and indeed, yeah, they obviously do get through a lot of work in Michael Skipper's system. So yeah, I guess at the end of the day, they've just got to pocket the point themselves here and look to get back to winning ways this coming weekend.
Yeah, I think we need to point out as well, because I was complaining about Gamba having like two midweek games back to back, that the first midweek game was the rescheduled game with Hiroshima, so that they're sure, also yeah. they've played back to back midweek games. So, and as you mentioned, with that Skiba system, it's not you really need to rotate. I think Sam made a good point a couple of weeks ago about new foreign managers like kind of coming into the league and not really understanding the need for rotation, because it just is so hot, like relentlessly hot in the summer. And he went for the interesting, I would call it a newbie move, but I think that might be a bit too rough on him, but of essentially just rotating everyone in one game and treating this game almost like Levan Cup, which is backfired. But whether in the long run it actually works out more, because maybe certain players were susceptible to injury or the likes. If you throw in that kind of that group of five games they've played, they also lost at Gamba, it wasn't a great performance either. So that's two, it's like 5 points they've dropped in games that they wouldn't really expect to. Whereas at least they lost at Marinos, but they can balance that out by the fact they beat Marinos at home. Yeah, I think Skibber might need to look at how he rotates the squads. And also, yeah, I think I've seen San Francisco Hiroshima fans online that they're really begging for a natural goal scorer, because I think Ben Khalifa is a decent player, but he's not going to get you too many goals. And Junior Santos, I don't really have the adjectives to describe Junior Santos, to be honest. So much talent, but so much waste. And they've really kind of relied on the players further back, like Mitsuta, Morishima, Fuji, for the creativity and goals. I guess in their favour is that, like after the EAFF Cup, league-wise, the schedule really, really levels out. So if Hiroshima, like, they really have to finish in the top six. I don't see them finishing out of the top six. Top three is possible, maybe fourth to sixth, I would say, with a good shot at the Emperor's Cup. If I was Sam Fritchie, I'd probably be going for fourth and an Emperor's Cup triumph. I think that would make a pretty good season. Could you see them going any higher than fourth, Ben? Like, how realistic do you think like the top three finish would be for Hiroshima?
Yeah, I think well, when they're in the midst of that winning run, Johnny, it looked like anything was possible. But yeah, I think their lack of real quality depth is ultimately going to cost them a top three spot. But again, if there's any sort of drop off with Antlers after Weda's departure, then I guess it's not completely out of the realms of possibility. I think, as we're going to come on to shortly, I'm personally drawing the line at the current top six. I think that they will, you know, settle amongst themselves the top six positions. And yeah, Hiroshima will definitely be involved in the battle for the ACL places. I think. Whether it's a season, maybe even two seasons too soon for them to talk about a serious push at the title, we'll wait and see. Again, I could end up with egg on my face in that regard. But the ACL is, well, of course, they're fourth, so it is in play. It's most definitely in play. And they've, their surge up the table has been absolutely tremendous. And I would back them in. Again, with that, still the concerns over the depth of their squad, but I would back them in to hang around in the top six and be sniffing around for an ACL spot. And yeah, sure, I could see them going. I could see them going a long way in the Emperor's Cup as well. It would be just a remarkable turnaround to see them back up at the sharp end of the table at the end of the season, after they had become pretty much an afterthought in the past couple of seasons. All right, so well done to Sean Hunt for battling out another point away from home, and at the end of a long run of games, Hiroshima ultimately happy to come from a losing position and bank a point themselves. Next we'll head to the real estate agent in front of the Station Stadium down in Tosu, where host Sagan were back in action, but still missing a couple of players due to COVID protocols. And a couple of players were a bit naughty in midweek, as Johnny might talk us through later on. But it was visiting Kashiwa who prevailed with Yuki Muto making the most of a rare but deserved start after some lively performances off the bench in recent games, who settled matters with a crisp strike from the edge of the box after he sprung the Tosu offside trap in the 19th minute. A minute from halftime, Muto almost made it 2-0, but his lob over Park Il-gyu came back off the post, and Tosu were held at bay in the second half as Raisul arrested a run of three straight defeats and consolidated themselves in the top six, edging back above Cerezo into fifth. So, Johnny, before I get your thoughts on this game, we'll bring in Gabanello's second question for us to ponder. Gab says Kashua started in pre-season with almost certain relegation hanging over them. 6 months later, they have developed many youngsters, including Masato Sasaki in goal, that allowed them to sell Kim Sung-gyu, and they've gathered enough points for salvation. And even now, Yuki Muto is back to being a football player. Is this the story of the season?
It's the J League. There's a lot of stories of the season. I don't want to be pinned down and just choosing one, but I'll definitely meet him on is one of the stories of the season. I think you said a few weeks ago, Ben, you were, I think you put Kashua to go down, and you were shocked about them being up in fourth. I didn't quite have them to go down, but if you'd said to me after 21 rounds there's still like 9 or 10 teams who genuinely have to look over their shoulders and worry about relegation, and Kashua are not one of them, then yeah, I would have found that quite hard to believe. You know, with Cerezo conceding those late goals, they've stayed up in fifth. I think Cerezo, they're only a point behind. I can see Cerezo going above Kashua, and I think we'll come on to the next game, Urawa. If they continue to get their act together like they've done in the last sort of 5 or 6 games, that Urawa are only 7 points behind with 13 to go. I think Urawa could catch them. I'm very comfortable in saying Kashua will definitely finish in the top 8, which again, probably even amongst a lot of their support would be welcome, because I think they only finished 7th the year they had Olunga. So yeah, 5th after 21 games. I have to say, me and Sam both laid into Nelsinho on numerous occasions last year, but well done to him for turning it around. And as Gab points out, numerous youngsters, Sasaki the latest off the production line. So yeah, I think, again, as you said, Ben, with Sam Fredshee, it's maybe a year or two early for them to peak. But Nelsinho, with his age, whether he's the one that sees them to the peak, I'm not sure. But I think he's definitely turned them into a team that's going in the right direction. And yeah, I think, yeah, after the disappointment last year, I think they ended up 15th to finish top 6, top 7, top 8. I think that would be realistic. I think you might actually be slightly more positive on them. I've got them top 8, but what about you, Ben?
Well, yeah, I could see them hanging around. And I mean, yeah, mentioned Nelsinho. Of course, I had him as my manager of the half season, because it was, I just could not fathom at the start of the season this was possible. And it's not simply down to him, of course, but, you know, he deserves a lot of credit, because a lot of us were ready to show him the door. And he's shown, faith in youth, and he's got his players well organized, and they've to say they've done the business is a massive understatement. And after 3 straight losses to go away from home against a slightly depleted, but on the other hand, arrested Tosu, who didn't have to play on Wednesday, and to come back with all 3 points and a clean sheet is a further feather in his cap, I think. And Gab, thanks for your questions, and well done to Raisul on their victory. And we've kind of danced around it in the past few minutes, but yeah, I'm drawing the line at 6th place Cerezo, Johnny. So yeah, I've got Raisul in the top 6, and I think I just don't see enough consistency in the teams below them, starting from, of course, FC Tokyo, who are 7th, from them down, although, of course, Tosu do have a game in hand after last Wednesday's postponement, but that is away at the defending champions. Yes, you could certainly make the case that Reds are capable of going on a late run and giving the top 6 a nudge, but yeah, I mean, similarly to Frontale, I'm not sure how much they can really take away from Saturday night's win over Gumba, considering the early red card and having to play against 10 men for 80 plus minutes. I mean, again, Reds supporters are cock-a-hoop, and they have every right to be after defeating FC Tokyo 3-0. But again, I don't know if they've learnt too many lessons from this game, because Tokyo were simply abject and just gave the ball away on a continuous basis. That meant they were the architects of their own downfall in this game. It was one of those where you can tell from the first few minutes, once maybe the second or the third time that Keigo Higashi passed the ball directly to a Reds player, and it must have been catching, because even Masato Morishige did it a few times, and it was pretty apparent that Tokyo just weren't on it, and Reds ultimately cruised to a 3-0 victory. Again, I don't want to take anything away from them. They were the livelier team, no question. And they took their chance as well. They were able to win the ball back from Tokyo on a far too regular basis for my liking. And a thoroughly deserved win for Reds. Yusuke Matsuo set up David Moberg for the easiest goal he'll ever score. Just past the half hour, then Atsuki Ito's superb strike from almost 30 yards out, 5 minutes into the second half, basically killed the game off and made it 2-0. Tomoaki Okubo added salt to Tokyo wounds with a fine close-range finish with 20 minutes left. Tokyo's only real moment of inspiration was a spectacular 35-yard free kick from Kuryu Matsuki that hit the post 5 minutes before half time. But when you're relying on a 35-yard free kick to get you back into a game, then that's an indication that it just wasn't happening in open play for Tokyo. Leandro had a couple of long-range second-half efforts battered away by Shusaku Nishikawa, but ultimately it was far too comfortable for Reds, Johnny. Ralph Akakichino 11. I was always going to do that through gritted teeth, mate. But it was ultimately a very much deserved win, as I hope I've gotten across there for Reds. And I'm sure you enjoyed your evening at Saitama Stadium. I guess I probably should stop now, Johnny. But it was very emphatic by Reds.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that you could see in the first few minutes that Tokyo weren't at the races. And I think Red seemed to be the kind of team, like, if they start on the front foot, they start well, then they keep going. It's just this red tide. Like, you watched the whole game. I only caught the highlights, but the first half was essentially just a commentator saying Matsuo, 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 Moberg, Matsuo, Matsuo. And that's how it went. And it was interesting to see they had Matsuo started as a centre forward the last 2 weeks, and it seems to be doing the business. But yeah, Reds, they just need to stop drawing games, which they seem to have started doing, that they're scoring more often. But you know, this game, they got three goals, they won 3-0. I think they beat Nagoya 3-0 at home. They had that famous comeback against Mariners, it was 3-3, and I think they beat Jubilo 4-1. So that's four games they scored 13 goals. But they've only scored 25 in total, so that's more than half of their total. They've only scored 12 in the other 17. All of those games I mentioned were at home. So they seem to be able to do it on occasions at home. Whereas away, I think the last away game was Gamba. They've now got four goals in 10 away games, none from open play. So something's really not clicking there. But in front of their home fans, once they get up ahead of steam, things do seem to be working. They've only lost one of the last 15 games, the second in the form table of the last five. As I mentioned earlier, they're only 7 points off Kashiwa. They're only six off Cerezo as well. I don't know if they could catch them, but there were six last year. It's not impossible they could get six again, especially as I think from this weekend, I'm not sure if he will play, but they've brought in Brian Linson from Feyenoord, who I believe he's got 13 goals and 8 assists last year in the Eredivisie. At 31, he might be slightly past his peak, but he does seem to be someone who has a real pedigree. He could come in and be top scorer this year. You never know with Ueda leaving, but someone who you'd think next year might be sort of challenging the top of the charts. And that's really what Reds need, isn't it? Because you mentioned Moberg will never have an easiest goal. He almost missed it. He almost passed it straight to Slovic for that first goal. So, but I think he's at 6-12, so a few penalties in there. And it seems like him and Juncker are the only players in the squad, I'd say, are particularly clinical finishers. yeah, the amount of times Reds just, like, I think Matsuo hit the bar in midweek in the last minute against Kyoto, and there was a game I think you and Sam were talking about a few weeks ago at Fukuoka. They hit the post twice. Like, in a couple of games, you can say that's unlucky, but it's been all season with Reds. Like, I don't have much hair left to tear out about Gamba. I don't know about Ralph how much hair he's got, but I think Reds fans must really be feeling like, what are we doing wrong this season? Sometimes they have, I think as Ralph mentioned it, they tend to create better chances in the opposition, but they also tend to find new and wonderful ways to miss them. Unfortunately for your Tokyo team, that was not one of those days on Sunday. And I think I don't think you mentioned it, Shusaku Nishikawa. I think he broke the record for most clean sheets in J1. I believe it was 170. I read that on Twitter. So it's a fair play to him on that. And I know, I think Ralph's got another question, but maybe before we came to that, I wanted to ask you maybe about a couple of things. Once was, I think it was Yuki Kajiura. He started here, and he started also in midweek. What were your thoughts on him? And also you mentioned Leandro, because I think last year you played more of a 4-2-3-1, and he was a number 10, whereas Pudgy's playing a kind of 4-3-3. So when fit, he's been out on the wing. How has that affected his effectiveness? So what do you think about those kind of two questions?
Yeah, I mean, Kajiura, he got through Wednesday night against Sapporo, but again, that was a game that Tokyo are ultimately able to cruise through. He looks neat and tidy enough on the ball, but again, he's kind of similarly to Matsuki in his first couple of games this season. I think the physical nature of J1 obviously goes without saying, it takes a lot of getting used to for young players. And I mean, he was far too meek in the build up to Urawa's first goal, and I guess he was a bit of a sacrificial lamb at half time. And some will have been surprised to not see Kazuya Konno start, and he was introduced for Kajiura at the break. I guess he's one for the future, and he's one that if Pucci's going to bring through some players, then you want to see him given a chance to fail, hopefully he'll be able to begin to express himself in the weeks to come if he's given an extended run in the team. As for Leandro, he's he's the great enigma. He's obviously capable of the spectacular, and in open play he looked to be Tokyo's most likely source of inspiration, as is often the case, of course, and with a Dalton absent from the squad on Sunday night. So again, whether he is really at the end of the day a Pucci sort of player, I think we'll find out. Every team needs a maverick, and Pucci might decide that Leandro is worth persisting with. We've just begun to see, as I mentioned earlier today, the first lot of dead wood cut adrift from the Tokyo squad in the summer, with Kensuke Nagai rejoining Nagoya on a full transfer, and Yojiro Takahagi joining Tochigi on a loan move until the end of January next year. So he's obviously got a lot more players that he would want to get out of the squad over the next couple of transfer windows, Pucci. But the process has begun, and you mentioned that there was another question from Ralph, Johnny, and it's about some of the J2 players from last season who have joined up with the Urawa Red squad this year. And so Ralph's wondering, I guess, a bit of a just past the halfway point of the season, a status check on some of them.
Yeah, and first of all, actually, before I forget, I wanted to say thank you to Ralph for reading my blog, because I always like to get feedback from fans of other teams, because it is a bit Gamba centric, but I do like to give other teams a fair crack and kind of go through logically and consistently what the good points and bad points. So thank you very much for supporting and commenting. In terms of what he asked, how I interpreted it was, I think he asked in pre-season about, kind of rather tongue in cheek, about Cerezo and Urawa signing lots of players from my scouting articles last year. So I've gone through the kind of five players that Reds have brought in from J2 in squad number order. So I think there's Kazuaki Mawatari, and I think he was brought in as backup, and he covered right back and left back quite well earlier in the season when there were injuries. The goalkeeper, Ayumi Niikawa, I still don't really understand that signing, because he was very good for Mito in J2. He's a tall, agile keeper, and there's teams that near the foot of J1, I think he could start at, but he's far too good to be a number three at Reds, but I don't think he's good enough to be number one. So I interpreted his signing as a sign that Zion Suzuki would go out on loan, but that's not happened yet. So maybe Ralph knows more than me. I'm not sure why they signed him. The best signing I think they've made is Kenny Wow, but I was a bit on the fence with him at the start of the season. I think he struggled a little bit, but three assists in his last five games, and Reds significantly have scored in each of those five games, which has been a problem. So I think he's done well. Then you've got Tatsuya Chinen, who came in from Ryukyu. I think he probably needs to go out on loan in the second half of the year, but possibly to a team like Kyoto, or maybe even like Machida in J2 to get some games. And then Kai Matsuzaki, I think he played at the start of the season, but he's kind of been swarmed out with players coming back from injury or people like Moberg coming into the country. Again, a Fukuoka or Kyoto style loan, I think, might do him the world of good. So I think in terms of players Reds have brought in from J2, a bit of a mixed bag. And yeah, unfortunately for Ralph and Urawa, and also maybe for myself, I think Cerezo are definitely the champions of J2 recruitment. As I mentioned, say Amaikuma, I think he got over as an injury or COVID, whatever he had at the start of the season. He's been an excellent addition to their starting 11, and it's no surprise to me to see him jump up instantly from J2 and become a regular in a top six J1 club. Satoki Uejo, he played really well against Marinos, and he scored a beautiful goal against Gamba in the Levan Cup, and I think he's had injury problems, but he's done all right. And also Hikaru Nakahara, I think he played more at the start of the year and has been kind of crowded out. If you throw them together with Mutsuki Kato, and they've also got like games out of Toriyumi and Takeda, who I thought looked poor signings from Jeff last year. Like, what were they doing? That's six players who have come directly from J2 clubs that have all made decent contributions to Cerezo this season. So, yeah, it might pain me to say it, but I think Cerezo are leading the way in terms of J2 scouting. So, yeah, maybe a couple of other J1 clubs could maybe tap them on the shoulder and ask them for some advice. But thanks again to Ralph for his question, and I hope I've answered it in a satisfactory way.
Yeah, terrific stuff. Very thorough there, Johnny. Very much appreciated. I'm sure Ralph echoes my sentiment there. So, just another indication of things are looking very bright for Cerezo at this stage. But also good to see that Reds have gotten some games out of their out of the players that they brought in from J2. And obviously Ricardo Rodriguez might need to call on some of those players again for the remainder of the season if they they don't get shipped out on loan in the meantime. All right then. So again, thanks for your questions, Ralph, and congratulations on the victory, thoroughly deserved, as I mentioned. So let's switch our attention to the foot of the table, and the musical chairs in the bottom three continued over the weekend. Of course, the Kobe sent Shimizu to the cellar thanks to Yuya Osako's late winner in the Battle of the Bottom on Wednesday night. Then Osako was added again as the Vissel did the same to Iwata on Saturday, with the Shimizu's 2-0 away win over Nagoya taking them off the foot of the table. So it's a 1-2 punch of the two Shizuoka teams in the two automatic relegation spots after match day 21. We'll begin this mini wrap at the bottom at the Yamaha Stadium. The Iwata centre back Ricardo Grassa made some terrific blocks throughout the game. The best of them in the 8th minute when he somehow denied Yoshinori Muto, who looked certain to score after rounding the keeper. But inside the last 20 minutes, he brought down Muto in the box, and Osako netted his second winner off the bench of the week as he slammed home the spot kick in the 76th minute to give Vissel their third straight win and edge them up to 16th, Johnny. So, well, I guess they were looking dead and buried just three match days ago, but we all knew about the quality of the players in the squad. They just had to get one win to build some sort of momentum. And now you look up and they've won three on the spin and they're up to 16th.
Yeah, I think that the big key here is that they've won ugly, which I think I've spoke to a couple of people about this, and it's one of these things that sounds counterintuitive to, you know, teams like Gamba or Wiesel or Urawa, who are accustomed to being up in the top third, top six, seven, eight. When they find themselves down there, you know, it's easy to think we're a big team, we're a good team, we're good players, we're good last year. But I mean, Kobe have been in the relegation zone almost all year. I think there's a time they've got to a place where you have to park your pride outside and just win 1-0, scrappy 1-0 wins. What I would say is my evidence for that, I was lucky kind of around Golden Week. I was able to go to a lot of games live in the stadium, and I watched in quick succession Gamba at home to Shonan, Sapporo and Kobe. And where I sit, it's often quite close to where the opposition are warming up. And, you know, pre-match warm-up, Vissel Kobe blew Sapporo and Shonan out the water. They're spraying passes everywhere, hardly miss a shot. But then when the game's about to start, Shonan, Sapporo, battle stations ready. Everyone knows their job. Vissel players, they look genuinely surprised that Gamba players are trying to take the ball off them. It seems that they've cut that out, that they've realised we are going to go to J2 if we don't start winning games. And that's changed their whole mindset around. A little bit like what Gamba did last year when they had that COVID cluster, and they had some horribly ugly wins over, I think it's like Tokushima and Yokohama FC. But they did win the games. They got themselves out of the relegation zone. It just lifted the pressure around the place. And I think Kobe, they're only a point behind Gamba. I think it's a matter of time before they overtake Gamba. Even you're looking at the form, they're in, they're 4 points behind like Kyoto and Sapporo. So I think it might have been funny for some people for a while to imagine Iniesta and Osako and Co in J2. I'm not going to say at the moment, I'm not going to tie myself up in knots and say Vissel definitely won't go down. But I think now it's more likely they stay up than that they go down. What are your thoughts on the kind of latest revival, and do you see it continuing, or do you think there could be more kind of rocky stages ahead?
Oh, well, this is Vissel Kobe, so I'm sure it's not going to be smooth sailing from now until the end of the season. But I think they've he didn't score in either of these two games, but you can see what a fit and firing Muto can mean to Vissel. And obviously I say that through gritted teeth as well as an ex Tokyo player, and he could certainly do a job for FC Tokyo up front in Albert Pucci's system, I'm certain. But it's getting the best out of the quality players that they have. And whether it's just the handbrake is off with Mr. Lotina no longer around, and whether they'll actually muddle through with Takayuki Yoshida in charge until the end of the season, they'll try and bring someone in during the EAFF Cup break or later on in the summer to helm the ship until the end of the season. I mean, at this stage, Johnny, I mean, he's not a miracle worker, Mr. Yoshida. I'm sure of that. But the fact that they've won three straight games, I guess you don't want to keep him around into next season, but the fact that he's, the results speak for themselves, and a lot of it is down to having a fully fit squad at his disposal that Lotina hasn't always had through the first half of the season. But I don't know, would you be actually messing with this at the moment, or would you give Mr. Yoshida an extended run at it and see whether he can actually steer them to survival before you worry about getting a new manager on board?
Yeah, I'm a bit in two minds, because I think Kobe were playing impossibly bad for the first 15 or so games of the season. So bad that I imagine I could probably coach them to better results by just saying get on with it. I don't know how they managed to get the results they did. So in some extent, they had to start winning games at some point. And they seem, whatever Tosu have over FC Tokyo, Kobe seemed to have over Tosu, and they beat them, and then they've beaten the bottom two.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say they haven't returned to last season's third place form yet, but it is essentially still the same squad that finished third. And Yoshida did very poorly with Nagasaki last year, so I'm not going to say he's the messiah. I'm quite a cautious person, so I would say, 21 games played this season, you've been in the bottom three for most of it. Just finishing outside the relegation zone is essentially a success from here. So I would be wary of tinkering, but I am not Mr. Mikitani, and I would be very surprised if Yoshida is still the coach at the end of the season. I think you'll bring someone in, and you mentioned there's the EAFF Cup sooner rather than later. I would be betting on Kobe having a different coach by the end of the year. I have a little kind of Excel spreadsheet where I keep a lot of my stats. VSL actually made me add in an extra bar because they'd used so many coaches, it ran out of space. That's never happened in like 5 or 6 years of doing that before. So I've got another line with some space. I'm betting there's at least another name to go in there. What about you? Do you agree Mr. Mkhitany might be tempted to make a move in the next month or so?
Well, yes, he certainly has previous, doesn't he? But I think it's just a breath of fresh air for the players to not have Lotina around. And I mean, you know, I'm sure he's a lovely fella, but if the stories are true, then you know the atmosphere that he instills in his squad is often counterproductive. And I think you can just see that there's a weight lifted off. Again, they haven't played the cream of the crop of the league, and they've beaten the team they always beat, and then as you say, they've beaten the bottom two. But you had to start somewhere, and this squad of quality players who, as you said, finished third last season, have enough quality to dig themselves out. And whether it's just a manager who lets them go out there with the handbrake off, then hopefully that's Mr. Yoshida, and hopefully he can see them through to the end of the year. But yes, again, with the huge understanding that it is Mkhitany, and probably by the time this podcast is released, Kobe will announce a new manager from abroad. So we're certainly watching this space, but good to see that the Kobe Giant has finally awoken from its slumber. And while there is a long way to go, and they certainly need a lot more points to consider themselves safe, they are at least now in with a fighting chance. We'll next head then to the Toyota Stadium, where host Nagoya almost made the perfect start against Shimizu when Leo Silva curled a shot against the post in the first minute. Yoichiro Kakitani later fired across the face of goal, as is his wont, but S-Pulse took a superb lead 7 minutes before the break when Keita Nishizawa raced onto Carlinhos' ball into the centre and sent a terrific first-time shot from inside the D past Mitch Langerak. The same pair combined again at the start of the second half, but this time Nishizawa's shot grazed the outside of Langerak's right-hand post. Sho Inagaki volleyed home a bouncing ball in the 49th minute, but the goal was disallowed after a questionable, at best, offside decision against Mateus in the build-up. It looked a very harsh one, Johnny. The big question is it drop-worthy?
Yes, it is.
This week in VAR.
Well, I've already had a bit of a rant about the Gamba sending off, and I've also mentioned about what happened in the Cerezo game. Here is the opposite side of the coin, but what I think VAR is almost like a killjoy in football. It sends off players who don't necessarily need to be sent off. And then a disallowed goal by Inagaki. I haven't seen an angle that says to me that is offside. It looks for me all the money like it is onside, yet it's not even reviewed. There's what, 15, 20 seconds the referee's talking to the VAR people and they say, no, it's fine. Fans like you or I, and I saw Graham Frecci on Twitter commenting about it, but it's like there's no communication with the fans. Why are we wasting minutes and minutes to send people off on a technicality? When remembering football is a spectator sport, so I feel like the goal should be to keep 11 against 11 on the field. And then this is a tight game. Both of these teams are not having the best of season. It's 1-0 start of the second half. If Nagoya get the equaliser, it's all to play for. I don't know how they've come to the decision they have. I don't know how they've come to it so quickly. It's like they seem to make things worse with VAR. A yellow goes to a red, a goal gets disallowed, but it's very rare to see the opposite. Doesn't seem to happen very often. So yeah, it's a bit of a killjoy, and I often watch J2 and I actually enjoy it now, because when the ball goes in the net, you know it's a goal. And when it's a yellow, you know it's a yellow. Granted, that wouldn't have happened. That wouldn't really have helped Nagoya in this situation because it wouldn't have been a goal in J2. But yeah, I'm not a Nagoya fan. I'm not a Shimizu fan, but I was frustrated on behalf of Inagaki and Nagoya. I'd like to know an explanation as to why that's not been given. What's your take, Ben?
Yeah, as I said, it looked questionable. Is again being generous to the officials. He looked level at worst, Mateus. And I don't know how instructive really the DAZN highlights package is, but there's a moment where they show the only angle that we see when Leo Silva plays the ball through to Mateus, and there's applause in the crowd. So I can only assume that it was actually shown on the screen at the Toyota Stadium, and all of the home supporters are like, "Yeah, look, he's onside," so they're going to allow the goal, right? And then instead, it goes to the next action where there's another chance for Grampus, and nothing comes of it. But yeah, it is frustrating. You find yourself just unable to celebrate goals, or your first thought is, oh God, I hope he's I hope he's onside. Whereas, as you say, in J2, in leagues where VAR is not applied, then a goal is a goal if the linesman's flag hasn't been raised. So. It did look a very difficult one for Grampus to take. I mean, you know, it's swings and roundabouts. Obviously, Antlers didn't have the rub of the green away at Nagoya a couple of weeks ago. That doesn't take anything away from the fact that, you know, this goal should have stood for Inagaki. But, what can you do? It was, I mean, the way you phrase it is right. It is just a killjoy, and it's taking a lot of the enjoyment. And obviously, it goes without saying the spontaneity of enjoying a football match away when, it appears your team has scored a legitimate goal, and you simply don't know why it's been taken away, or it just looks frankly wrong. At the end of the day. So, that was obviously a difficult one for Grampus to take. It just wasn't Nagoya's night. The central defender, Shinosuke Nakatani's a deft touch on a delicious ball into the box by Hiroyuki Abe in the 72nd minute came back off the post. Then the veteran defender, Yutaka Yoshida, who had only been on the pitch for 10 minutes, was shown a straight red card for bringing down Shimizu sub Takeru Kishimoto on a counter-attack in the 88th minute. Thiago Santana applied the icing on the cake deep into second half stoppage time, one of the few choices I got right in my fantasy wildcard. Thiago raced 30 yards through the center and then fired past Mitch Langerak from distance via a deflection for his third goal in as many games. But a couple of talking points from some of the players that we've mentioned here in the second half action, Johnny. Somewhat curiously, Hiroyuki Abe played for Nagoya in what I guess amounted to a farewell match for him. And also your thoughts on the red card for Yoshida so late on.
Yeah, well, I'll start with Yoshida. I've tried, because I was having a bit of a rant about Okuno, I've tried to take the side of the players. I really can't do much to defend Yoshida here. It's on an angle, but he's last man, and he slides in wildly. He's taking out whoever's there. So I'm sorry, I like him, but it's a red card. I can sympathise with Nagoya with the goal being chopped off. This, I think, he has to go. And interestingly, the player he took out, Takeru Kishimoto, it seems like Z Ricardo's found him wandering around the Shimizu training ground, because he was a very good player for Tokushima last year. I have no idea why he went to Shimizu, who already had a couple of good right backs. But I think he ended up assisting the goal for Santana, which really just summed up Nagoya's day. I think the way it sort of took a couple of deflections through and it's deflected and bounces in. I think that summed up how things went for Nagoya. Abe, I messaged you about him earlier. I've seen this with, like, you know, recently, like Ogawa went overseas, or you get players who get their big move to Europe, but going on loan to Shonan and then staying with the team for another week and coming on. I don't know. I think I was checking Twitter tonight, there was a COVID case at Nagoya. I don't know if there was cases before the game, because there's a couple of players on the bench, including one from the under-18s who hadn't been in the match day squad this year. So I don't know if it was simply out of necessity. But I think Abe, he might be quite a decent player for Shonan, because they're doing well, but they're still, despite that four-goal blitz at Kawasaki, they've only got 18 goals in 21 games. So he might be a decent addition. And then, again, on the flip side, I think you talked about the new striker, Naldo, coming in at Nagoya. They've also added a couple of midfielders, Takuya Shigehiro from Fukuoka, and then Yuta Nagaki is coming from Shonan to Nagoya, the opposite way from Abe. Mm-hmm. And then today, as you mentioned, Kensuke Nagai coming in. I don't really know what to make of these. There are areas that need upgraded, but I'm always kind of reminded there was an old, I think it was like Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares, and he went into some place that had, I think, like 40 things on the menu, and he said, well, why do you have 40 things in the menu? Just make five and make them really well. Mm. And I'm not particularly having a go at Nagoya here. This is a league-wide thing where you need one striker. Like, Reds have brought in Brian Linson. He's got a good pedigree. So many times teams will bring in two or three players in the one position. You just go for quantity over quality. And there's no one that Nagoya have brought in that I instantly think that they're going to make a massive difference. You know, their position, they're 11th now. They're actually closer to the bottom than they are to sixth place. I think there is enough there at Nagoya. They can probably stick around that sort of 9th to 11th place. But, yeah, none of these players particularly grab the eye of, yeah, they're going to make Nagoya significantly better. And I can see them just kind of drifting around in mid-table. What about you? Any more positive or negative on them?
No, I mean, it's the Kenta Hasegawa effect, isn't it? And I was going to come on to actually ask you your thoughts on the two managers of the two teams from the game at the Toyota Stadium on Sunday. But yeah, it's some of the names that they're bringing in. I mean, you know, I've just watched Nagai for the last 5.5 years play for Tokyo. I mean, we all know that he's rapid, but we all know that he can't hit a barn door. So, I mean, he's not going to be the answer to their goal-scoring problem, as Yoichiro Kakitani wasn't. So, it's just, as you say, just adding more names to an already cluttered squad. And it as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't make things any easier at all for Hasegawa in terms of settling on an 11 that he feels can take Nagoya back up the table. Because they're one of the huge disappointments of this season. I don't think there's any question. So Nagoya are mired in Hasegawa-ville, but on the flip side, Shimizu have shown signs of life, I suppose, since Zé Ricardo's arrival, Johnny. Of course, they won his first game in charge against Fukuoka, then drew against Cerezo, played the game of the season at the National Stadium against Yokohama F. Marinos before losing to, very late on, to Kobe in midweek, and then, went away from home and defeated Nagoya here. So are you seeing, it's very early days, but are you seeing, positive signs for Shimizu? Again, Sam has jumped off the bandwagon, but recently gotten back on. So do you see, enough in them that they could be, hauling themselves, I guess, doing a Shonan in the weeks to come and hauling themselves up to touching distance of mid-table?
I'm kind of on the fence because Shonan in many ways seem like a very well-run club, where Shimizu are, I'm looking at the league table now and there's Vissel Kobe above them, and Shimizu often make equally baffling decisions in terms of player recruitment and also what they do with managers. Zé Ricardo on paper does seem like a very good choice, and they're 17th now. I can definitely see them finishing higher than 17th, but I don't, they may finish completely clear of even the 16th place relegation spot, but I don't see them ever being in a position where they're not worrying about relegation. Mm. I think there's been rumours that Zé Ricardo is unsatisfied with some of the foreign players, and Shimizu are a serial offender of having about 7 or 8 foreigners on their books. And you know, they do things like Thiago Santana has come in and been brilliant since he's come back. He was out injured, and then they brought in Osei Hoon when Thiago Santana came back. It's basically the same kind of player. There's so many good wide players, but the central defence, I only really see Yoshinori Suzuki as being a decent J1 level player. Central midfield's a bit of an issue. He's gone with the same formation, and he's probably riding a wave of all the players being fit, or all the key players being fit, specifically Santana. Yes, with S-Pulse's recent history, and I always feel I need to add the caveat, I actually quite like S-Pulse. They've got a beautiful kit and a beautiful uniform. I'm not having a go at them personally. I do not understand what their front office thinks with some of their decisions. There's not enough like terrible teams above them for them to clearly haul themselves away from that bottom three in the last 13 games. So I'd say they probably won't go down, but they're not. It's not going to be easy. There's a bit of squeaky bum time down there, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, we've seen enough of a sample size, you know, so far this season to appreciate the fact that it's going to be a slog for S-Pulse, but. I think for a lot of people, they're a second or third favourite J1 club. So, a lot of people will be hoping that they're able to, edge their way up the table and ultimately to safety. But, Zay Ricardo, obviously a lot of work to do in the meantime. But, it was a fruitful trip to the Toyota Stadium. And, Grampus, the hosts, ended with nothing and, stuck in mid-table themselves. All right, well, finally then, are we saving the best to last? Well, if you're an Avispa Fukuoka supporter, then yes, we most certainly are. It was a great week for Fukuoka and Yuya Yamagishi in particular. After netting the only goal of the game early in the second half away at Iwata on Wednesday, Yamagishi was at it again at the Best Denki Stadium on Sunday night. His sixth-minute volley from 6 yards out after the Kyoto defence failed to clear a Jordy Crooks corner was enough to see off Sanga and take Avispa back above their visitors in the table. Johnny, Fukuoka back to what served them so well last season, and these two results will be a massive fillip to Takumi Nagaishi, the young goalkeeper taking over recently, that raised some eyebrows, of course, from the veteran Masaaki Murakami, and notching back-to-back clean sheets this week. His low save from a Shogo Asada header with 15 minutes left preserved the 3 points for his side.
Yeah, I talked about Kobe winning ugly this week, and Fukuoka have basically done the same thing, 1-0 away to Jubilo and then 1-0 at home to Kyoto. It's not, I mean this in the nicest possible way, Fukuoka fans, it's not particularly pretty, but it's very effective. And yeah, Yuya Yamagishi, who I think Gamba had an offer accepted for him, and he put out a very nice statement where he said nice things about Gamba, but he didn't feel his work at Fukuoka was finished. He's certainly shown his value to Fukuoka, and he showed Gamba what they're missing with two great goals, a lovely finish here, and ultimately it's been the difference between the two teams. And as you said, Nagaishi, a couple of great saves, and he was also helped out with a couple of really good blocks by his defenders. And I think also there's the news, we're talking about transfers, and John Mary is back, which is a bit of a surprise given that it's the same coach, it's the same system, and he wasn't really used that much last year. So it'll be interesting to see how much he plays when he comes in. I think Fukuoka, there's 6 points clear of the drop zone. I think there are comfortably 3, 4, 5, 6 teams weaker than them in the league. Again, they're 10th now. I think they maybe finish 2 or 3 places lower than that. But yeah, I think they're reasonably safe. If John Mary adds a few goals, I think they'll be okay. I think there's rumours as well of Kaio Cesar from Nagasaki, but he seemed to be back in the Nagasaki team. He'd be a big upgrade as well in midfield. I think Kyoto, on the other hand, I'm less positive about them. If you look over the last like 12 games, 2 wins, 2 draws, 8 defeats. You know, if they keep that run going, they're not staying up. But Utaka's got 1 goal in his last 10 games, and I've talked several times about everyone having 3 games this week. Utaka played 90 minutes 3 times last week, which fair play to him. It's a fair effort in his age in this weather. But I think if Kyoto don't get someone in, even on loan, to help take up that goal-scoring burden away from him, I have to say Kyoto, I think, might, 4 points above Vissel. I think that's going to be eaten up in no time. Shimizu are 4 points behind. Yeah, They're still in 12th. They've been hanging around the mid-table for a bit, but I think 13 games to go. At the moment, if I was a betting man, I'd have Kyoto to go down. But how about you? What I said about Fukuoka and also Kyoto, would you go along with that, Ben?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, Fukuoka, I know Sam will be wrapped at John Mary's back in the fold and might have already ordered his kit once his squad number is confirmed again. But, we don't want to damn them with faint praise, but yeah, it's not always pretty, but it's generally effective what Fukuoka did, and it obviously served them so well, as I said, last season. So yeah, to be getting back to their steady defensive ways from last year, and then the X factor of Yamagishi in these past couple of games, but he's also been, you know, their most likely avenue to goal pretty much all season, with Lukiana, of course, only firing when they play against FC Tokyo, and a general lack of goals from elsewhere in the squad. So he's been hugely important for them, and there's only 2 points separating these sides, and until this three-game unbeaten run they're on now, obviously Fukuoka were starting to seriously look over their shoulders. So I'm sure Avispa supporters aren't counting any chickens at the moment as they sit 6 points outside the drop zone. But, these two results in the past week will, give them and their squad, enormous confidence for the rest of the summer. And, they'll hope to secure their J1 status as quickly as possible. As for Kyoto, well, I can see why, especially Sam and yourself are doubters, Johnny. It does look like their slide has begun. And, I mean, it just makes, you know, outliers like the win over Kawasaki before the last international break, all the more head-scratching, I suppose. You know that they're capable of results like these. But there just hasn't been the consistency in the past couple of months. So, it's too close to call, obviously, at this stage. But, yeah, there are a number of teams that will be taking part in the relegation dogfight for what's left of the season. And, yeah, it's kind of weird. I guess I was used to a 38-game season last year, Johnny, with 20 clubs in J1. But, yeah, when you look at it and there are only, in inverted commas, 13 games to go. We're not quite in the stretch run yet, but some of these teams are really going to have to sharpen up their axe in the next month or so, aren't they? Or they're really going to be stuck down in the mire.
It's interesting because the way this season, because the World Cup's at the end, it's all been condensed up to the start. So you've got a run now of most teams have only got 13 league games to play. And some of these teams are also, they're out of one or both cup competitions. So, you know, we're talking about the summer transfer window. A lot of these players coming in, especially to the back end of the window, they don't actually have that many games left to play. So, yeah, anyone, I'd say, from Fukuoka down, everyone needs to really bring their A game, every game from now on. There's no midweek rounds to go, so you can play your strongest 11. And, yeah, you know, there's Gamba, Vissel, Shimizu, they're all still down there. Nagoya are down there. I'm not saying even two or three of those teams would go down, but I think definitely that this year there is the potential for, again, as we say, quote-unquote big name to take the plunge, with potentially the two newly promoted teams like Jubilo and Kyoto. I think the ones I'm most confident seeing are in the biggest danger alongside a potential big name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, fair enough then. All right, well, thanks, Johnny. That's all of the 9 games from J1 Match Day 21 rounded up then. So, what's up in the next week on the slate, you might ask listeners? Well, in Match Day 22, we have 7 games taking place on Saturday and then 2 on Sunday before the league takes a 2-week break for the EAFF Cup. Obviously, Johnny, your attention will be focused solely on the Panasonic Stadium at 7 o'clock on Saturday night when Gamba host Cerezo in the Osaka Derby. But if you wouldn't mind, for the sake of the listeners, if a neutral might want to check out another game or two over the course of the weekend, what is Johnny's pick of the weekend trademark? Johnny's
pick of the weekend.
I think I will go with actually the first game that I've got written down, which is Kashima against Vissel Kobe. Because Kashima are in need of a big performance after a sort of letdown away to Sapporo. We don't know if Yuma Suzuki is going to be there. And Kobe, again, three games in a row. The same players are there that played last season. So I don't think there's going to be an inferiority complex from those players, like Muto, Osako. Well, Osako's back at Kashima. Iniesta, that they're not going to have much of an inferiority complex going to Kashima. So that I think, for a neutral, that's a very interesting game. I would throw in, that's my pick of the week, with also throwing in Shimizu Urawa, because, Shimizu, as we mentioned, that they're down in 17th. Urawa are finding form. We've mentioned just there that teams need to bring their A game for the remaining 13 games. If Shimizu lose, that's a home game lost. It's one more game that leaves them in the relegation zone. Reds again, then, I mean, they're only 3 points behind Tokyo in seventh. They could potentially, like, if results go their way, that they could jump up to seventh, because the other game we mentioned is Tosu at home to Yokohama F Marinos. And as we've seen from Saga and Tosu, they can give any team a run for their money. Literally, as I think these two teams are two of the hardest workers in terms of, like, running stats. So that'll be a good one to watch as well. So I think, if you include the Osaka Derby as well, there's four very good games on the cards. And then I think your boys are in action on Sunday, Ben, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. Maybe not recommended viewing when FC Tokyo host Iwata. I can't promise much, listeners, but I suppose if you're at a bit of a loose end at 6 p.m. JST on Sunday, then, I guess there's worse things you could do than watch Kuryu Matsuki try and run the midfield for FC Tokyo against Iwata. Also on Sunday, Kyoto versus Hiroshima holds some level of intrigue. But, I agree with your first two shouts there, Johnny. Just the unfortunate thing is for the listeners that both Kashima Kobe and Shimizu Urawa kick off at 6 o'clock on Saturday. So unless you're like Sam and have multiple screens at your disposal, you're going to have to make a difficult choice there. Both games do look very intriguing. As Johnny's mentioned, F Marinos are away at Tosu on Saturday night, and Frontale are also away, so looking to continue their good form from the previous round when they travel to Nagoya. So, all right then, well, that's just about it, Johnny. In true J-Talk big pod form, we've almost managed, well, we've managed an hour and 45 minutes, which is our stock in trade. So it's great to know that you can take one of the co-hosts out, but a very able fellow to step into his boots, and the podcast doesn't miss a beat. So we're once again thrilled that you could join us and share all of your knowledge and input on the top flight. So Johnny, thank you ever so much for doing such a sterling job on this week's episode.
Thanks very much again for having me, Ben. I hope everyone enjoyed my insights. I was genuinely worried about how long are we being able to talk about these games for. So it's surprising to know we've gone an hour and 45 minutes. I hope Sam enjoys his holiday, and hopefully you have a relatively calm week next week with less VAR and red card controversies. But I'm sure I'll be back on at some point in the future. So thanks again for having me. Thank you.
No worries. And that's an absolute promise, Johnny. We'll be hassling you to be back on numerous times before the end of this season. I can promise you that. So, we'll wish Gumba good luck for the derby on Saturday night. And again, thank you for joining us on this episode. Thanks as well, of course, to all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/jtalkpod. And listeners, it goes without saying, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. All right, and that listeners this week, of course, include Sam. I hope Sam has enjoyed this episode on his return from the Emerald Isle, and that he's had an excellent break and is fit and raring to go for next week's episode. All right, so that's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. We'll be back next week to review J1 Match Day 22. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast. Yes, 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 yes.